Doug is with the Federal Geographic Data Committee in the United States. He's a senior advisor for geospatial technology and system of systems architect for the FGDC. He's been involved in the U.S. national spatial data infrastructure for many years. He was instrumental in the inception of the FGDC metadata standard and development of the NSDI clearinghouse network and other technological components of the U.S. NSDI, and also worked with GSDI activities. So, Doug, we'll turn it over to you.
All right. My name is Doug Niebert with the U.S. Federal Geographic Data Committee. We're housed at the U.S. Geological Survey, and since the early 90s have been charged with coordinating access to spatial information, maps, geographic data in general. More recently, we're providing facilities to search metadata on services as well as data. And I've been involved over the last 3 or 4 years increasingly in a group on Earth observation in Washington next week, which is over 60 countries and, I don't know, over 75 professional organizations that are interested in providing access to easy access to Earth observation data to support societal benefit areas. So it's in many ways in the space community, but also in E2 observation groups, making their networks available so that people can solve problems. Next slide. So initially, just up front, I'm not an ontologist. I have a very general sense of what this means. I have problems that I need to solve, and what I'd like to do today is present the areas in which I see ontologies or standardized vocabularies are essential in integrating access to information across what are always heterogeneous communities. The FGDC by nature, or culture by nature, is multidisciplinary. So we have many, many providers, and the only thing that brings them to the table here is that they have a sense of place. There's a location associated with it. The actual discipline, the organization, the problems that they solve are very, very different, which means we have many vocabularies, sets of terminology, disciplines that have to discover each other in this concept space. So, I mean, if we just going back there a second, I mean, you could say, well, you know, spatial ontology, isn't that just place names? We already have gazetteers that tell us how to organize information, and I'll get a little bit further into that, but I would suggest this is just one of the capabilities that's available to you in terms of an organized discipline of geography. There's a Getty Thesaurus of geographic names. I don't know if people are aware, but the Getty Museum has been for many years building a place and concept register, what they call their thesaurus, which is hierarchical, which they use for their museums. So they want to know not just current locations, but historical locations, like where was Babel, where was Babylon, and when did things transition, so you can actually search for artifacts that are associated with place and time. There's also in the U.S. the Geographic Names Information System, which is an official Board of Geographic Names set of approved official place names, and they have locations and contexts associated with them. Next. As was mentioned in the last presentation, Max Eggenhofer has done a lot in terms of building spatial ontologies and some of the mathematics behind conceiving of space, the concept of relationships between objects, so things that are within or overlaps or touches, is fundamental to actual operations within geographic information systems and GIS software processing, but it's an explicit topology. And as was suggested in the prior talk also, there are implicit topologies, things like near or under or above or is approaching that need a context that again, are helpful if we can establish what that predicate language is. So there are things that Max suggests in terms of standardization of spatial categories of operations and relationships. Next slide. So I'm going to focus on these four areas to talk about in terms of where we need standardization in the geospatial community, where it's helpful for us to be able to communicate across different disciplines, and the resources that are there to support it. The first one would be gazetteer place name hierarchies, which I mentioned, and I'll go into a little bit greater detail. concept of spatial operation, spatial relationships and association, vocabularies, and spatial feature typology. Next slide. So there are gazetteer interfaces that are available, and down here is the Getty Thesaurus, which is online in an interactive form where you can browse through up and down more general terms or enclosing concepts like continents down to countries down to, in this case, I've got the world, North and Central America, the Cayman Islands, the Grand Cayman as an island, and Georgetown as a city on Grand Cayman Island. So they're building in an organic way this gazetteer of places, and there's identifiers associated with them, which allows you through this thesaurus mechanism to go up and down that tree. Find things that are islands, or I can find things that live in the Caribbean, or I can find things that are on a specific island in the Caribbean. So there are identifiers or IDs associated with each of these, and they're persistent, so they could be used or assigned based on words that might be discovered in metadata or descriptions of these news stories and put into a geographic context. USGS has a feature name dictionary, it's gazetteer, for the United States, and NEMA, the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, has an outside the U.S. gazetteer of place names. There's some 2.5-3 million different features that are managed, including critical values for those place names. So it's an anglicized name, a romanized name, names that have diacritics as well as in other languages, as well as a context of X balls within Y. Next slide. So typically a gazetteer provides a set of landmark feature types, and the types aren't consistent globally, but there are maybe 30 or 40 different kinds of things that tend to be named and managed as official names around the world. There's a discipline associated with this in building gazetteers, which wants printed books. And one would open the gazetteer and look for printed names in alphabetical order. As a byproduct, they have a latitude and longitude associated with where the text was placed on the map, typically. Not necessarily the centroid of the feature, not necessarily associated with an area or a polygon even. And it wasn't until we had GISs and we said, oh, there's latitude and longitude, what if we put that on a map? Did we discover how good or how bad those geographies were? And what the opportunity would be to introduce more complex geographies or geometries associated with place names. Typically, geographic hierarchies are managed and applied, so that containment idea that we saw on the prior slide from Getty, where you can have continents having countries having first order, second order, third order divisions, and then individual physical landmarks like mountains, these monuments, having a point location associated with their official location and definition. There's also, in this practice, alternate official, historical, and other variant names. So there may be a preferred name. In the U.S., there's only one official name, and there may be other variants that are historical, but they don't want confusion. So in the BGN, there's one official name. There may be local or foreign names. There may be Native American names are included in that list. It can be useful for orientation, for refining search, providing geographic context. So in many online systems, people will be given the opportunity with map interface to say, well, you know, zoom me into some place, and based on the context, it would take you to the location that you think you're looking. Well, those are typically driven by gazetteer search. Next slide. So, you know, which New York? This is the geospatial one-stop interface that allows access to all of you that geographic information. And this is the advanced search. But you can say, I'm looking for Hudson River in New York. Well, the interface is smart enough to say, excuse me, New York has a lot of different representations. You might not realize there's a New York, Florida. There is a city of New York in Florida. They probably brought it with them when they went from New York to Florida. But you can pick which one you're talking about and look at what the context is. And then that assigns not just a point location, but a bounding box or some kind of a region in which New York has a footprint. So it can be helpful to have gazetteers of official names to avoid the misspelling or multiple spellings or keystrokes that would take you to the wrong location. And you don't expect that people are going to memorize latitude and longitude. So having geography is extremely important in getting a sense of where information is, what its footprint is on the ground, in order to provide a context for people's search. Next slide. In the context of performing geographic analysis, there are a number of spatial operations and relationships that others have gone into in great detail, including Max Eggenhofer and others, like the RCC5. You know, there are explicit mathematical proofs that say I'm in, I'm enclosed, I touch, and there are terms associated with that and they're reproducible. Again, on the geometry as opposed to the geography of the features themselves, there are also contextual relational terms that may have a very specific meaning in different contexts that you would have to explain in math or in other constructs. Things like near, far, adjacent, what does near mean? How near? And what's the precision of the object that you're describing near associated with? Things that you need in navigation in terms of passes over, under, on, through. Neighborhood, region as concepts. What does that mean to a specific community? And things like along and beside. You know, I'm not on the road, I'm off the road to one side, as we saw in some of the diagrams in the prior slideshow. Next slide. Here's Eggenhofer's four intersection matrix. So these are basically eight properties that you could think of in terms of the relationship here of just simple or area features, black relative to white. So things don't touch, they're disjoint. If one contains the other, there's a containment operator, there's inside, equal, meet, covers, covered by an overlap. Some of these can be collapsed into simpler dimensions such as in, out, touch. So you can generalize that and then have that abstraction determined by the geometry relationships of those features. So if I had footprints of my places of interest, I'd be able to tell you what the relationship or the significance is of my area of interest relative to the footprints of interest. Next slide. So we do this a lot in terms of searching for geographic information. Where there's a metadata record, it has a footprint of its coverage. As just like in the card catalog, it doesn't contain all of the data, but it contains enough basic information to allow us to discover whether I should go get that information, that data set, or not. In terms of vocabulary, there are quite a few enumerations and code lists out there in geospatial domain within our community that can be useful and reusable, again, by establishing common identifier systems. So to avoid some of the just type in whatever you want and we'll try and do forcing text matches, which we find not to work very well, having things like place code identifiers, there are keys or codes or coordinate reference systems, projection parameters so that they can be used and reused predictably. There are parameter or attribute value types that may be codified through ISO or the Open Geospatial Consortium or elsewhere. Again, to standardize the vocabulary, the codes or keys that you're using instead of having to guess if something means the same thing. Also, there are service types and standards and URNs that are available, again, to standardize the vocabulary to minimize confusion. Next slide. There are geo-enabled basin codes in terms of data that are out there in fields, columns within spreadsheets or geographic data sets, or even quasi-geographic data sets that we can, what we call geo-enable. So by taking a spreadsheet that has a county or a country name in it, we can turn that into a mappable resource because you may have dozens of health parameters that I'll show you, for example, associated with countries, but no means to really put it into the map and use it with other geographic data. So again, from a point of standardization, it's very helpful to know what those codes are and to be able to exploit them in terms of fusion and mapping them into geographic information. Things like address, zip codes, or zip plus four, and with centroids, state, county, country, city codes and names that are out there. There are international standards for 2 and 3 letter and number country codes and political subdivision codes that can be exploited. Things like congressional district also have codes over time. Next slide. So here's an example of some health data that I found the other day just to illustrate that this comes from the Pan American Health Organization, PAHO. They have a search widget basically says we have a huge database. What parameters do you want to map? And what do you want columns to be? And what do you want your rows to be? And I said, well, I wanted to look at infant mortality and some other mortality statistics by country in the Americas. So it generates for you an Excel spreadsheet over on the side. And then by going to services such as the GeoCommons, which is a fusion service that lets you take spreadsheet data, decipher where you have geographic keys, and put it in the map for you, unless you symbolize the map directly. You can take what is essentially a person prepared the table, didn't think of it as spatial data. It wasn't in a GIS. It was just a table. You can actually put it into not just a map, but into a spatial database that could be used with other information. Next slide. So here's one of their mapping interfaces built off of this at AHO, which is, I think it's done through Flash, but you can see this is H1N1 as of this week, and all of the down to the state level and, well, first order political subdivisions within all the countries in the Americas, you can see what the hot spots are, who had more occurrences over what period of time, again, by taking tabular information and geography and putting them together. Next slide. The group on Earth observation, we're using standard terminology for standards, so that we, the OGC and ISO, have what are called URNs, uniform resource names, which are like strings that are unique within a namespace that allow us to refer to something without having to decide whether I capitalize or lowercase or put underscores or spaces in between. So the GEO is establishing a registry of standards. They're not making standards, but people in the community are defining standards that are relevant to them, putting them in this registry, finding what the URNs are, and then our systems allow us to link between the different, when somebody comes in with a resource, a data set, or a service, they pick from a list that comes out of the standards. So again, by establishing that common identifier system, it makes an explicit relationship. I won't call it an ontology, but it's more of a vocabulary that can be used, again, to bridge across. Next slide. Another typical coding system we see would be EPSG-43226. There's a set of projections, nicknames. So they're 4 and 5-digit codes that embody whole sets of parameters that are used in mathematics of projecting data from one system to another. Now, you can type all those parameters in and mean the same thing, but the chances of you typing it in twice the same way is pretty close to null. So having this nickname system, like a URN, allows the community to be explicit in saying, here is the spatial context that my coordinates live in. If you want to put it in another one, you can perform a transformation because those parameters are known. Next slide. One of the most important, from an ontology point of view, one of the most important aspects in the spatial community is this concept of feature or feature classes catalogs. So these are the things in the real world that are mapped or described and what properties they have. There is standardization underway around the world and defining these, especially for vector kinds of geographic information, things that are represented as points, lines, and areas on maps, or could be done as such. I mean, that health data is an example. That's an aerial kind of a data set, areas of being countries in that case. But by defining some standard meanings of what these terms are in a landscape, we can standardize the vocabulary of the landscape and the relationships that may exist between those feature types, as well as instances of given feature types. So in this case, we have an Antarctic data center, a joint operation between the U.S. and Australia, where they're managing all the feature types. You wouldn't think Antarctica would have a lot of different feature types. How many ways can you say snow? But there are many different landmark or geographic features, and the international interest, there are multiple languages associated with the definition of those features. So we have mountain. I did a search on mounts. There's subglacial mountains and mountains and a definition thereof. And if you go farther into the database, it has the Norwegian and Russian and other language equivalents of these terms and concepts. So it allows us to start to do navigation of similar terms across different languages in different disciplines. Next slide. The Joint Research Center in Europe is working on an international a mandate now within the European Commission across Europe to standardize geographic information. It's what's being collected in, well, they have three annexes of different geographic features or themes. Themes have feature types, and so this is an example of themes, and there are feature type dictionary that goes on behind it, getting down to things like mountain and road segments, etc., to standardize them across all of the languages of Europe, as well as the context for their use in digital geographic information. So if you were to click on buildings, then you would get information about buildings. Click it, please. Slow build there. So this is an example of not just having a term, a definition associated with a term. And I really think in the world of ontology, having explicit definitions or descriptions is important, because you need to know what somebody said, who's the authority who said it, so you can start to determine what the context of that definition might be. Next slide. We're working with George Mason University to build some capabilities for the group on Earth observation and GEOS. And when we are working on semantic-based knowledge reasoning for intelligent search, basically building a, we'll call it a common GEOS ontology, but it's really more of a linked ontology based on many sources. And we'll be starting with the GEOS Earth observation parameters. The only cohesion that the group on Earth observation has is that there are things being observed, whether they are the results of a model or something being sensed in the landscape, something on the surface or under the water. It could be in situ measurements such as tide or earthquake. It could be moving measurements from satellites. But if you boil it down to the basics, you start to get what these observables or parameters are that they're describing. And there's an extremely large number of resources that are being described in different communities. There's 9 societal benefit areas that are officially recognized within GEO. So bringing in these vocabularies from the different fields and then starting to draw equivalences through expert assertions to say, yes, A is really equivalent to B, or A is a more general term than B, will allow us to start navigating what observation resources are available, but also linking to what user requirements exist on observations. So somebody says, I'm doing salmon modeling and I need this kind of information. They can articulate it in a way that it goes into the common vocabulary, and it can be matched or a gap can be determined against what kinds of parameters are being collected there. So we're using the GEOS Earth Observations, the Committee on Earth Observing Satellites. They have Earth Observation Parameters, NOAA and NASA, as I'm working with. There are the inspired themes, and on spatial ontology that I showed you in the last slide, and we also have in the U.S. a set of framework data standards with similar definitions of feature types, about 120 different feature types that we manage in the U.S. Next slide. So right now, based on the merge of these, there are 500 terms and relationships and 37 logic restrictions that have been put on this combination is being expressed in OWL or OWL-DL. And is navigable. So we're trying to see how we can integrate this ultimately to have a more logical search across mined metadata resources. So when people in GEO are registering an Earth observation data set or service or system, that the information that they describe in terms of the keywords or the observations can be matched in, you know, some kind of a qualitative way to say this is going to be suitable or not for what you're looking for. Next slide. So here are a few views. Of course, that's unintelligible, but ontology snapshot, we'll have themes and spatial object types. And spatial object types themselves are the lowest level that's being managed here. They can be grouped into any number of themes. So you can imagine something like station or tower could exist in multiple themes of categorization, and that's okay, because it has a physical property, but it may have a different context than how the tower is being applied. Is it a transmission tower? Is it an observation tower? Is it an obstacle? You know, is the role, how is that going to go across? Next slide. So here's a zoom in. We have, in terms of the parameters, here's cloud type. And so many of the observation or observables include things like the cloud ice profile, cloud top temperature, cloud top height, cloud imagery, cloud optical depth. So these are parameters that are reported by the community to say these are things we observe, we collect numbers on, and here are the sensors that provide that. So the goal in a year or two is to be able to use this to allow people to navigate what things are being registered with GEO, and also, again, to identify what those user requirements are to say, I have this, and it can be satisfied by these seven sources, or it doesn't appear that anyone is satisfying this. I'm asking for something that hasn't either been specified the same level, or it's just not being collected, and it could be used to help prioritize new Earth observation collection. Next slide. We're using something called the GEO Network Portal, which is a catalog and an interactive web portal system, and have pushed in these parameters in the SKOS format, different knowledge representation format than OWL, that basically dumped out of OWL, so that we can perform some navigation. So there's some rudimentary vocabulary or thesauri navigation tools built into GEO Network. Right now, they don't integrate with the search capability. They integrate with your filling in a form, or you're allowing to put in volunteering words in a search, an advanced search form. But what we would like to do is use this to do term expansion. So when somebody comes in and says, I'm looking for ice, then we can say, well, ice is also associated with these parameters or these observations here. So you could elect to have your term based on its context, expanded into A or B or C to make a more logical or comprehensive search across the hundreds of thousands of records that will be within GEO. Next slide. George Mason is also building or has built a GEO bridge for metacatalogs. They're working with the Global Change Master Directory, the National Climate Data Center, the Earth Science Gateway, and ECHO at NASA, each of which have slightly different communities and different ontologies, and they're building a service layer interface that will act as a mediator across these different collections so that one, again, can expand a query or perform a query across this heterogeneous space, even though it's science, it's four or five different discipline focuses. And they use AJAX to interact with it and XML. There's a map client that lets you look at the results that are found back based on the geography. Next slide. This is kind of restating what we're doing in GEO, the Group on Earth Observation. We really do need this common feature type or property ontology for the observation types there because we have these diverse societal benefit areas. And forcing the authors to categorize or classify all their metadata coming in is not easy. It's not natural. And as soon as we enforce one classification scheme, it will change. So what we would rather do is have the natural characteristics of the metadata, which is detailed and structured, be used to help mine and classify the information based on the observables and other contexts. So to improve search based on the context of the information itself. But by managing these observable properties, we'll be able to join user or application requirements with the Earth observation availability and identify gaps. So user requirements registry is in the design process right now to link up to the component and service data registry, and our link will be done through that set of common observables. And it'll be organic in that as a user nominates certain observables, if they're not already there, then they go into the system. And the same thing as providers nominate observables, if they're not already there, then they go into the system. So it's based on the capabilities or the requirements coming in rather than just an abstract list of all concepts from A to Z. Next slide. There's another initiative in the Arctic. The Arctic Spatial Data Infrastructure is underway this week. The Arctic Council is approving an initiative by the 8 northern or polar countries, or 8 official countries in the north. And they want to provide multidisciplinary, multilingual search against scientific data in the Arctic region. So to do this, we have multiple languages and disciplines, and in support of that, we're also looking at the multilingual thesaurus from Europe, GEMET, the INSPIRE feature concept catalog, the observation types, the SWEET ontology, which is for Earth sciences, and the NASA GCMD IDM science keywords. Again, a combination of those where we can start to build assertions to connect equivalent or similar terms together in order to publish and discover information and be able to either download it or use it in a mapped context in the northern environment. So this is supporting the GEO activities, but also the Arctic Council in a very specific effort. So it's one case, we'll say, within the group on Earth observation, a community of interest, where we're going to be applying these ontologies. That concludes my presentation. Am I close to on time?